Hello, this is Elton Banks from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And we begin as usual with the biz page from Triangle Business Journal. And the first article today is about a milestone. MD celebrates 100 years and recalls World War II bomber flights. On September the 25th, the day after Sam Robertson's birthday, about 50 old friends, family members, elected officials, and members of the public gathered to celebrate with him at his business in downtown Clayton. You see, it was a signature birthday celebration, the 100th, for the World War II veteran. That day also marked Robertson's induction into the Order of the Longleaf Pine, the state of North Carolina's highest honor. During the festivities, the Duke University graduate regaled the crowd with stories of how Clayton looked when its main street was just a dirt road. Robertson was drafted into the U.S. Army in World War II and survived flying missions, cramped inside the glass ball turret on the underbelly of a B-17 flying fortress. He later settled in Clayton and joined the family business, B.M. Robertson Mule Barn, where he still keeps office hours every day. It's there he uses his true identity, Sam Robertson, M.D., that is, mule dealer. And also on today's biz page comes the article from the heading Entrepreneur about Cynthia Hill, entitled, She Has More Cooking Than Just a Chef's Life. The co-producer of the wildly popular A Chef's Life is a bit of an accidental entrepreneur when it comes to real estate in Durham. Cynthia Hill, who launched the show with fellow Lenoir County product Vivian Howard, has used some astute real estate investments and the growth of Durham to help fuel her film career. She likes to joke that she got into real estate because she didn't have a 401k. She was working in pharmacy, yearned to get into film, and saw real estate as a way to provide an income stream. Her first purchase was the old Penny Furniture County building in downtown Durham for $470,000. I remember the closing of the first building in 2004, she says. It was literally when hardly anyone was there. People were like, downtown Durham? You're going to get shot. But she benefited from easier loan requirements at the time, and also the fact that she could put her office in the building. I like being that pioneer. I'd walk my dog at night by myself and not see a single soul. Now downtown, it's so busy. Now she has three commercial buildings, some residential property she leases, and a 4,000-square-foot Victorian home in Trinity Park that she renovated. Oh, and she has that TV show, too. Her Marque Media is co-producer of A Chef's Life, which returns to PBS for its fifth season in October, continuing a stunning run that attracts millions of viewers per episode. And under the heading of Hunting Season comes the article, Connecting Hunters to Land. For many in North Carolina, fall means hunting season, and a Virginia company is seeking to capture that interest by becoming sort of the Airbnb for hunters and outdoorsmen. Outdoor Access, based in Richmond, allows landowners to rent their land to hunters, fishermen, and campers for a fee. Chief Marketing Officer Buck Robinson says the year-old site has about 200 listings, with most in Virginia, and about 1,000 members overall. It's grown tremendously. Our expectation is over the course of the next 60 to 90 days, with the hunting season, that number will go up to 300-plus listings and 3,000 members, Robinson says. Landowners set their own price and then pay a booking fee and an 8% commission. Members join for $99. Robinson says it appeals to newcomers and also members of the military. They want to get out in the field but don't know where to start, he says. The company has gained $2.3 million in funding, Robinson says, including $1 million from an unnamed Raleigh investor. And finally, from the biz page comes the article, Raleigh Leader Returning to Local Law Firm. Jim Kane, the former U.S. Ambassador to Denmark and former president of the Carolina Hurricanes Hockey Club, is going back with the Raleigh law firm that jump-started his career. Kane, age 59, tells Biz the timing is perfect to join his old law firm. Kilpatrick Townsend, as an of counsel, a role that will allow him to work on community initiatives with clients and use his overstuffed Rolodex. This returns me to the practice of law and retains the leadership role in the law firm, he said. Following the end of his ambassadorship term, after the departure of President George W. Bush, Cain started Cain Global Partners, with offices in New York and London, that helped U.S. companies and wealthy individuals set up business and franchise operations abroad. Cain says he will continue to support CGP's efforts. Cain says the sudden death of Gary Joyner, the former managing partner of Kilpatrick, was one of the reasons he's going back to the law firm that will allow him to fulfill his community obligations. Cain's first order of business with Kilpatrick, help close the change of the ownership structure of the Cains, he says. In many respects, it's coming full circle, since I was in the middle of it when the team first came to town. Good luck, Jim. Now moving on to the On Technology and Banking page. Under the heading Executive Change comes the article, Durham's Cree Taps Low to CEO's Role. 4 months after the resignation of longtime CEO Chuck Swoboda, Cree has named a new top executive. The Durham LED maker announced on September 25 that Greg Lowe will take on the president and CEO role effective September 27. Swoboda, who resigned in May, will remain on the board until the annual shareholder meeting October 24. In a statement, Lowe thanks Swoboda for her 16 years of leadership at Cree, saying that it helped solidify Cree as an industry leader. He added, Cree's innovation engine is unmatched in the industry. I'm honored to be a part of this team and look forward to working with the employees and the board to establish and execute a clear vision for the company moving forward. In a note to investors, CFRA research analyst Angelo Zeno wrote that the hiring makes sense given his background in the semiconductor industry. We believe Mr. Lowe's work in the industrial and consumer markets will be an asset, and note he can help with Cree's intent to penetrate into the automotive space, he wrote. We also note Mr. Lowe's experience in deal-making. Previously, Lowe led Freescale Semiconductor, a $5 billion company with 17,000 employees serving multiple industries such as automobiles and communications. Prior to that, he spent nearly 30 years at Texas Instruments. Zeno maintains a hold rating on Cree shares. And in other banking news regarding veterans, Raleigh bankers, comes the article, UCB picks veteran Raleigh banker. United Community Bank has named John Lowe, a veteran Triangle banker, to lead its commercial team in Raleigh. It's the bank's latest Triangle strategy play as it works to close on its buy of Four Oaks FinCorp. Lowe, whose title is Senior Vice President and Triangle Commercial Banking Manager, is tasked with expanding the Georgia Bank's brand throughout the market. We had lots of conversation, he said, of his new employer. I wanted to make sure they understood how competitive this market is. One of the things I felt comfortable with is United Community is absolutely committed to giving us all the resources we need to be successful in the market. When its Four Oaks deal closes, expected by November the 1st, its new Triangle operation will get a big boost, he says. Prior to his new role, Lowe served as Senior Vice President Commercial Banking for Park Sterling Bank, which also is merging South Carolina's South State Corporation. Lowe's father, Vincent Lowe Jr., was a former CEO of BB&T. Also on the On Technology and Banking page comes the article, Public Records Detail, North Carolina's Efforts to Land Foxconn. Despite the state's best efforts and an incentives package worth about $570 million, North Carolina lost Foxconn Technology Group's $10 billion flat-screen factory to Wisconsin. Ultimately, the state couldn't compete with Wisconsin's $3 billion incentives package. But the more than 200 pages of emails and memos disclosed September the 22nd show a multi-agency rally for those jobs nonetheless. The project first pops up in an email on January the 30th with the subject line, hoping to discuss this project today. David Spratley, Vice President of Business Recruitment at the Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina, wrote that Fox could be an opportunity for North Carolina, but there's limited info. The emails between commerce officials picked up steam in May as the first of two meetings between Governor Roy Cooper and Foxconn executives were planned. Cooper and Commerce Secretary Tony Copeland met May the 10th with Alan Young, Director of U.S. Strategic Initiatives and Project Lead, along with other executives. Foxconn officials flew into Raleigh Executive Jetport in Sanford, ate dinner at ORO, and stayed at the Homewood Suites near Crabtree Valley Mall. But more importantly, they met with officials from entities such as NC State University and officials from the NC Community College system. A second delegation and site visit was planned for May 24th. The day before the meeting, a flurry of emails circulated on whether Cooper should address executives by their first names. Breakfast would include Taiwanese bread, and for lunch, authentic Chinese lunch boxes. The effort didn't end with the meeting, as multiple agency representatives wrote letters of support in June for the project. And in a June 1st letter to Young, Copeland wrote that if North Carolina were selected as a finalist, legislators might be coaxed into changing the JDIG program cap. The job creation proposed for these projects is so large that we may need to explore the feasibility of raising or eliminating the cap for a project of this magnitude, he wrote, adding that he is confident that he'll have legislative leadership support in luring the company. North Carolina submitted its official response on June 2nd, with an incentive estimate totaling nearly $570 million. The rallying continued as a June 28th letter signed by both U.S. Senators Tom Tillis and Richard Burr further tries to sell execs on North Carolina. The trail of public records stopped in late June for North Carolina. Foxconn made its announcements in July. And under the heading of land dispute comes the article, Local Cyclists Make Their Case for RDU Park Tract. The Raleigh-Durham International Airport land quandary comes down to this. Outdoor activists say, what anchors businesses, a park or a rock quarry? Gene Spooner, chair of the Umstead Coalition, and Natalie Liu, the head coach for middle and high school mountain bike team Southern Wake County Trailhawks, say they want to work with the airport as it develops its plan to meet the growth ahead. But instead of leasing land for a rock quarry, that's one of the options RDU has identified as a possibility, they hope an urban trail center or park expansion might fit into the tract's future. The Conservation Fund had offered $6.6 million to buy a tract and expand Umstead State Park. In issuing a request for lease proposals on September the 8th, RDU went with the flexibility of a lease over a purchase, Christy Van Auken, Vice President of Communications and Community Affairs, said. The reaction was instant. Bill Holman, North Carolina State Director of the Conservation Fund, said he was disappointed. The Umstead Coalition put out a statement saying it was horrified. The Southern Environmental Law Center sent RDU a letter September the 12th that questioned the legality of the rejection and accused the airport of violating the state's open meetings law. At the recent Airport Authority meeting, Aaron Locklear, general counsel for RDU, called SELC's assumptions incorrect, noting the authority didn't take the action during its closed session. The rejection was one of many staff have made on purchase offers over the years, and that doesn't require an open meeting, Locklear told the board. But regardless of legalities, Spooner calls the RFP deadline of October the 9th unreasonably short. And Liu says petitions have generated thousands of signatures in support of recreational use of the parcels. It can anchor a whole bunch of businesses, she notes. Spooner agrees. Would you anchor Dix Park with a new quarry, she says. Now we move to the On Pharmaceuticals page of this week's Triangle Business Journal. And the first article on pharmaceuticals is entitled, Dova Puts Drug in FDA's Hands. Following its IPO, which yielded net proceeds of about $80 million, Durham-based Dova Pharmaceuticals has submitted a new drug application, also called an NDA, to the U.S. Drug Administration for its lead drug. The NDA for Avatrombopag for the treatment of thrombocytopenia or low platelet count in patients with chronic liver disease. Avatrombopeg's U.S. launch could potentially be in 2018. Alex Sapir, president and CEO of Dova, said there are approximately 1.1 billion patients with chronic liver disease in the U.S. impacted by thrombocytopenia. The current standard of care is platelet transfusion, for which risks include bacterial infections and short time of effect. Dova was formed in March of 2016 and acquired Avatrombopeg from Eisai that same month. The company reported a net loss of $5.5 million for the second quarter of 2017, compared to a net loss of $7.3 million in the second quarter of 2016. The decrease was attributed to the completion of two Phase 3 clinical trials for Avatrombopeg at the beginning of this year. As of June 30th, prior to the close of its IPO, Dova stated that it had cash and equivalents of $24.8 million. And under the heading of research comes the article, FDA Approves Drug for Treating Kids with Flu. On the heels of an $80 million public offering, Research Triangle Park-based BioCryst Pharmaceuticals has landed U.S. Food and Drug Administration approval for its injectable flu treatment in pediatric patients. BioCryst submitted its supplemental new drug application for Rapivab earlier this year, with the FDA ultimately granting a priority review. In 2014, the FDA approved Rapivab for treating adults with the flu, and the firm has also been approved in a number of countries outside the United States. The company expects Rapivab to be ready for use in pediatric patients described as those 2 years and older who have been symptomatic for no more than 2 days soon. Outside of Rapivab, BioCryst is developing another product in the infectious disease space. It also has products for the treatment of hereditary angioedema, a rare genetic condition that causes swelling in parts of the body, including the extremities and the throat or airway. Earlier this month, BioCryst announced positive Phase 2 trial results for BCX7353 for the treatment of hereditary angioedema. The company's recent $80 million public offering is aimed at progressing BCX7353 to FDA approval and commercialization. That public offering, which follows a $45 million public offering in April, is intended to fund both of BioCryst's hereditary angioedema programs moving forward, up until the company's regulatory filing for BCX7353 with the FDA, as well as additional early discovery programs. Tom Stab, Senior Vice President and Chief Financial Officer of BioCryst, said recently, BCX7353 could be commercially available by 2020. The U.S. hereditary angioedema market is worth about $2 billion. Assuming BioCryst's other programs continue to progress as well, Stab notes that the company will require additional capital. For the first 6 months of the year, BioCryst reported total revenue of roughly $12.5 million, up from about $9.6 million for the same period the year prior. Its net loss was roughly $31.1 million for the first half of 2017, compared to $39.1 million for the first 6 months of 2016. BioCryst has 70 employees. And in other news from the pharmaceutical page, comes an article about a new office. Psy opens another international office. After opening a Durham office in April of 2016, Switzerland-based Psy, CRO, is continuing to expand its presence abroad and locally, opening its latest Asia-Pacific office, its third since the beginning of the year, in Taipei, Taiwan. Since the beginning of 2017, Psy has looked to the Asia-Pacific region in particular, in terms of building out and growing a base. It opened an office in Sydney earlier in the year and plans to open an office in Seoul, South Korea. The contract research organization plans to open an office in Hong Kong at the beginning of next year and is looking at a few additional regions to grow in. Psy's plan is to first establish a presence on the ground and then build up relationships in the region. All of our expansion into the Asia-Pacific region has been a natural response to industry needs, Director of Project Management Anthony Labrizzi said in a recent interview. It's an important region for clinical research in terms of new sponsors and clients, as well as patient populations, he added. Sai is looking to move into a larger office in Durham a little more than a year from opening, according to Director of North Carolina Operations Sabine Kroer-Debuschewitz. The company employs 27 people locally and wants to double that in the next 2 to 3 years. Globally, Sai employs about 1,600 people. And in the mergers and acquisitions front comes the article, Acquired Spinal Fusion Firm with Duke Ties. Vertera Spine, a startup with research origins at Duke University and the Georgia Institute of Technology, has been acquired by San Diego-based medical device company NuVasive, which reported revenue of more than $960 million last year. Ken Gall, chair of Duke's Department of Mechanical Engineering and Materials Science, co-founded Vertera in 2013 while working as a professor at Georgia Tech. NuVasive will use this to really dominate the market, he says. What we liked about them is they move fast and put a lot of value on technology. Vertera is developing and commercializing spinal fusion implants using a patented porous technology known as PEEK. The spinal fusion market alone is a couple of $1 billion, Gall says, adding that the technology could be applied to other areas of the body as well. Essentially, the technology is aimed at achieving higher probability of fusions and faster fusions, Gall says. At the time of its acquisition, Vertera had just achieved profitability, according to Gall. Financial terms of the acquisition are not being disclosed. Earlier this year, Vertera raised about $3.1 million in an equity offering. The company has received funding from the Georgia Research Alliance and the Duke Angel Network. While Gall says that neither Vertera nor NuVasive were looking for a deal prior to the acquisition, the companies were originally connected through surgeons at Duke and Rush University Medical Center in Chicago. Ultimately, NuVasive was interested in the technology that Vertera provided, and the company was a great partner for us, he says. Vertera, with roughly 20 employees, remains based in Atlanta. And, speaking of other news regarding Duke, comes the article, Duke Renews Big Contract with NIH Agency. The Duke Human Vaccine Institute has received a $41.5 million contract renewal from the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, part of the National Institutes of Health, also known as NIH. Duke's 7-year contract is for the External Quality Assurance Oversight Program Laboratory to provide quality control oversight for laboratories based globally that conduct HIV/AIDS research with NIH grants. The original contract was awarded back in 2010. And in 2014, the Duke Human Vaccine Institute received a contract extension worth up to $14 million. In 2016 alone, more than 20 North Carolina-based universities and businesses received $2 million or more in NIH funding, according to data compiled by American City Business Journals. Duke topped the list with close to $417 million in NIH funding. And under the news page for this week comes FDA recommends another trial for Novan treatment. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has advised Morrisville-based Novan that another trial should be conducted to progress the company's lead drug candidate SB20-4 for the treatment of acne toward approval. Novan previously said it had scheduled a pre-NDA, that's new drug application meeting, with the FDA in the third quarter of this year, but the company announced on September 25 that the FDA treated the meeting as a guidance meeting instead. Cash has continued to be a concern for Novan following mixed Phase 3 trial results for SB204 at the beginning of the year, which slashed its stock. Novan had about $19 million in cash as of June 30. On an investor call at the beginning of August, Novan's interim CEO, Kelly Martin, said the company would be able to determine what additional trial it would need to move SB204 forward, number, and type of patients, among other indicators of cost and overall the path forward when it comes to execution. We fully intend to move acne forward, Martin said. But the questions after clarity from the FDA will be what we are going to move forward and what is the business construct for that. On September the 25th, Martin said in a statement, we intend to update the marketplace as to the next steps for SB204 after having had the chance to review and verify the final FDA minutes and incorporate that input into the overall Novan plan. On September the 26th, the company announced that Michelle Sanders, Secretary of the North Carolina Department of Administration, has joined its board of directors. Sanders previously held several leadership positions at biotechnology giant Biogen in Research Triangle Park, including Vice President of Manufacturing and General Manager. I'm excited about joining Novan's board. I'm equally excited about Novan's product pipeline and commitment to areas of significant unmet medical needs in dermatology, Sanders said in a statement. I believe my leadership experience in global pharmaceutical and biotechnology manufacturing operations will be a valuable addition to Novan's board and strategic direction. Back in March, Novan added former Quintiles executive Paula Brown Stafford as the company's chief development officer. At the time, the company said that a focus of Stafford's would be upcoming interactions with the FDA as it relates to SB204. At the beginning of last month, Stafford was also appointed to Novan's board. And here's some news that may be of interest to those of you who are NC State fans. PNC Bank is now the official bank of NC State University. The 15-year contract, valued at $9 million, was announced September the 27th. PNC will offer a range of services to the NC State community, including free financial literacy workshops, 9 ATMs, a co-branded debit card, and student access to PNC's virtual wallet software. It really starts with a top university and strong financial institutions, both engaged in making sure tomorrow's workforce is well-equipped with resources relating to financial choices, technology, and access, says Jim Hansen, PNC's Eastern Carolina's regional president. This also is a way to connect with a student population who are just getting started in their lives with their financial strategies. For athletics, PNC will sponsor the school's Football Military Appreciation Day events and recognize athletes during the year for academic and leadership achievements. Now moving to the Around the State page, we have a couple of articles. One's entitled Greensboro's Revival Spurs Renewed Interest from Prominent Developer. For almost three decades, the Richardson family, whose local prominence dates back 126 years to the invention of Vicks VapoRub, has prospered from the shadows in their company's hometown. The family's legacy in business and philanthropy is evident throughout Greensboro, and its real estate company, Richardson Properties, made a major downtown play in the late 1980s, teaming with Capital Associates on the development of Renaissance Plaza, one of the city's dominant office towers. In recent memory, however, the company has remained quiet locally until now. Richardson Properties never left Greensboro, but much of its business focus had since the 1990s. As it watched the region's three dominant industries, tobacco, furniture, and textiles, struggling or eroding, Richardson Properties shifted to other more dynamic markets across the Carolinas, Virginia, and suburban Washington. So August the 1st, when Richardson announced that it was buying the remaining 54% interest in the 19-story Renaissance Plaza office building, the company was making a statement. That deal, plus its investment in an emerging apartment development and plans to expand an industrial property east of the city, indicate that Richardson sees promise again in its hometown. We feel this is another renaissance in Greensboro, says Richardson President and CEO David Irvin. Richardson Properties visualizes Greensboro as on the threshold of significant things. That's a dramatic turnabout from one of Greensboro's most influential families, which shed most of its Greensboro interest three decades ago. The family faced a crossroads in 1985 when Procter & Gamble paid $1.2 billion for Richardson Vicks, the public company that had emerged from Lunsford Richardson's creation of Vicks VapoRub in the late 19th century. Though the majority of the Richardson family, now in its sixth generation, lives elsewhere, and no family members currently works in the business, Richardson remains completely family-owned. The decision was made to pare down the business focused in Greensboro, Irvin says, of how the company pivoted in the late 80s and 90s. We decided to go to places where we could find good or unique opportunities to develop properties and keep them long-term. Such opportunities in Greensboro were few and far between at the time. We were in a lot of trouble, former Greensboro Mayor Jim Melvin recalls. We lost about 90,000 net jobs from 1982 until 2000. In the years since, Richardson has grown to in excess of $500 million in assets, Irvin says. Richardson has maintained a triad presence through the years, having in the late 80s and early 90s developed three office buildings in tandem with Starmount in Green Valley, that's at 628, 701, and 800 Green Valley Road. And in Winston-Salem, Richardson developed Pavilions Shopping Center. And this article was contributed from the Triad Business Journal. The other article on today's Around the State page is a bankruptcy article, North Carolina Hospitals Assets to be Sold at Auction. A bankruptcy judge has approved a motion allowing the sale of Moorhead Memorial Hospital's assets, positioning the Eden Hospital to have a new owner in little more than a month. The order by Judge Benjamin Kahn follows a Chapter 11 petition Moorhead Memorial filed earlier this year. The order sets October 23rd as the deadline for organizations to submit bids to purchase Moorhead Memorial's assets, with an auction to take place October 30th in the offices of Waldrop LLP in Winston-Salem. Assets not included in the sale include cash and cash equivalents. The expected takeover of Moorhead Memorial comes as rural hospitals across the nation are straining to keep their doors open. In order to stay operational, many rural hospitals are being gobbled up by larger systems, a reflection of the continuous consolidation in the healthcare industry. In North Carolina, industry consolidation recently reached a furor with the proposed merger of Carolina's healthcare system and UNC Healthcare. Moorhead Memorial, which remains open, has struggled financially in recent years, a result of a drop in patient volume, a decline in Medicaid and Medicare reimbursements, and rising medical costs. The hospital filed for bankruptcy on July 10th in the U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the Middle District of North Carolina. The hospital, which has almost 700 employees, has 108 acute care beds and operates Moorhead Nursing Center, a 121-bed facility. Moorhead Memorial has been managed by Novant Health since 2014, but the hospital has said it remains open to talking to other organizations as potential suitors. Moorhead Memorial is expected to file a notice October the 31st, revealing the organization that makes the successful bid for its assets. A hearing will take place on November the 6th on whether to approve the sale. Now we've reached this week's cover story, which is entitled Local Schools Spark Angel Networks. One firm that's a triangle company in every sense of the word is 410 Medical. Its founder and chief medical officer, Mark Pyle, a pediatric critical care physician at Wake Med, works at both Duke University and the UNC Chapel Hill School of Medicine, where he earned his medical degree. And the company's product, LifeFlow, designed to improve life-saving fluid delivery, was developed at NC State University. But local funding isn't often readily available to triangle startups like 410 Medical. This region has kind of ebbed and flowed in terms of the local capital available to these startups, says Kyle Chanette, CEO of 410 Medical. But now, angel networks at the four major triangle universities, that's Duke, UNC Chapel Hill, NC State, and NC Central University, are trying to change that. These networks are using their powerful alumni base to create an investor circle that would assist in financing startups. 410 Medical's Chanette says the schools have the strength and credibility to attract other entrepreneurs. It really enhances the region beyond just the absolute value of the finance goal, he says. As entrepreneurship becomes a focal point of academia, the strategy to tie alumni wealth with a startup ecosystem and university resources is getting traction among investors. NC State's Angel Network boasts 80 investors in its first year. UNC has 110, and Duke more than 110. NC State's network has invested $1.58 million in 7 companies in the first 10 months, and UNC has closed 4 deals by investing $780,000. In a Licensing Executives Society's chapter meeting last year, Duke Angel Networks' John Glushik noted that the group had invested some $2.3 million in 10 separate deals, and 4 more were under due diligence. Glushik also noted that only 4 of the Duke Angel Network's 75 angel members live in North Carolina. Duke says it has invested $6.1 million in 16 companies. Overall, the dollars are still small compared to the billions available in financial and technology source centers such as New York and Silicon Valley, but organizers say it's a start. We want to create the environment here in North Carolina that somebody with a good idea and a good technology and a good team can grow and build their company in North Carolina, that they don't have to move to Boston or Silicon Valley to raise funding, says Kelly Sexton, Assistant Vice Chancellor for Technology Commercialization and New Ventures at NC State. The angel investment model at universities across the country was first developed at MIT and Stanford, which started its program in 2010 and has helped fund more than 20 startups. In the Triangle, Duke jumped in first when the Duke Angel Network launched in June of 2015. Duke's success in finding deals and creating an angel investment model for its alumni caught the eyes of entrepreneurship programs at the other universities, including Sexton at NC State. "It's something we knew we needed to do. We hadn't really figured out the right way to go about it," she says. The Wolfpack Investor Network, sometimes called WIN, launched in September of 2016. Entrepreneurs affiliated with the universities can apply on each of the network's respective websites to obtain funding. From there, university-led staff, including MBA students, conduct due diligence on the company, and if it makes it through the vetting, present the company to investors. In Chapel Hill, the Carolina Angel Network, also known by its acronym CAN, was founded around the same time as NC State's, and followed the formation of the 2015 launch of the Carolina Research Ventures Fund, designed to help seed-stage companies coming out of the UNC that are still developing a product and often don't have full-time staff. "We said, you know, we have funding now to get an early-stage discovery or technology to the starting line, but we don't have funding for what are called early-stage companies, which usually means they have a fully developed product and are ready to go to market. In some cases, they've even got customers, and they've got a full-time founder," says Randy Meyer, CAN Managing Director. UNC estimates it has 70,000 accredited investors in its alumni base, so it's no surprise that the network has jumped to 110 members in just a year. An Angel Capital Association reports that the average angel network size nationally is 68 members. At NC Central, the Eagle Angel Network, also known as EAN, plans to launch next year. Managing Director Henry McCoy says, "With blacks comprising just 1% of funded startup founders, McCoy hopes the school can help increase diversity and entrepreneurship." McCoy says 25 to 30 investors have expressed interest. "This creation of angel investing via a university is really simply an outgrowth of this idea of a university being the educational ground for the next generation of entrepreneurs," McCoy adds. Many universities are working to foster entrepreneurship on campus as part of their curriculum. UNC established its Minor for Entrepreneurship in 2004, and in May, the program received a whopping $18 million boost from the Shuford family of Hickory. Siblings Jim, Stephen, and Dorothy Shuford are fifth-generation UNC alumni, and the family between SureTape Technologies, which makes the Duck brand tape. Allison Gardner, a venture partner at Fulcrum Equity Partners and former faculty member at Kenan Flagler Business School, was on the UNC Chapel Hill Board of Trustees during the launch of the entrepreneurship program. Gardner, now a network investor, says the idea of a university-affiliated angel network was once considered too radical. "We were just coming off of the first tech bubble. People were a little skittish at the time," he says. "That memory has faded. They see what Stanford and MIT have done, and I think that's become a culture of entrepreneurship which I would really credit mostly former Chancellor Holden Thorpe for starting. As more money is invested in entrepreneurship and research at the schools, the number of startups generated has grown. In fiscal year 2012, NC State launched just 4 startup companies, compared to 12 in 2015 and 2016. Those startups are contributing at the state's economy in a big way. An economic analysis conducted for UNC by Economic Modeling Specialists International determined that the businesses spun out of UNC in 2013 added $1.6 billion in income to the state, or the equivalent of 15,000 jobs. Gary Hoke, the Chief Technology Officer at National Agents Alliance in Burlington, first got involved with angel investing a few years ago. As an engineering graduate from NCSU, he decided to join WIN in December. Not only does having the university conduct due diligence save him many hours, but he says the diligence itself is more thorough. I definitely feel that with a network like WIN, you can view the due diligence, but also meet the people in person, meet the people who run the company, and really buy into that idea. That's something beyond the other angel networks that I've been a participant in, Hoke says. Because while intellectual property and ideas and processes are things you're investing in, it's ultimately the people who have to execute that mission and vision. Angels must have a net worth of more than $1 million, excluding the value of their home, or have earned more than $200,000 annually for the past 2 years to earn their wings as an SEC-accredited investor and participate in the programs at each of the 4 schools, in addition to being affiliated with the respective university. But David Gardner says because of the risk associated with angel investing, potential investors should have much more wealth than what the SEC requires. If you don't have a couple of $1 million to lose, you shouldn't be involved in it, he says. The chances are half the things you invest in are not going to make it. In a typical angel network, though, it's up to the investors to do the due diligence on a company, often making the process slow given members' busy lives. But the universities are turning that model on its head. With full-time staff and the help of the MBA and law students, the diligence process can be as quick as 30 days. Angel networks are only as strong as the members that participate in, says Joe Sinsheimer, managing director of WIN. A lot of the groups try to have members do the due diligence work, but that model is limited. Yes, they can offer their expertise or industry knowledge, but it's a very different from a university program where there's basically full-time employees who can garner all the intellectual assets of the university and put them behind a diligence effort for a new technology. The angel networks can be a boost for the companies as well, who can often spend 3 months to a year just waiting for an answer from most investment groups. From the time that I pitched to the time they closed their due diligence until the time we got funding was, from a venture perspective, a very short period of time, says Brian Hanley, CEO of a mobile audience data platform, Reveal Mobile, which received an investment of around $200,000 from WIN during its initial round and a follow-up investment of $305,000. There are times when it could take you months to go through the due diligence process and get funding. Members aren't the only ones with a stake in the companies presenting. Each of the schools have their own funds investing in the deals. UNC Chapel Hill's and Duke's funds, both of which started with a $2 million investment, pledged to match each angel investment made by network members at the discretion of the steering committee. NC State's Seed Capital Endowment Fund, which started with an initial $600,000, co-invests in deals with at least 3 members investing a combined $50,000 or more. Some of the participants are new to angel investment, Sexton says. It offers older alumni from the traditional economy a low barrier entry into an alternative investment class. The networks at UNC and NC State cost $1,500 per year, and Duke's $1,000 per year, and don't require the $50,000 to $100,000 capital commitment required of many other groups. Investors can pick and choose which of the companies to invest in. For Sims Preston, a graduate of the Duke School of Law, who has served as Associate General Counsel for Quintiles IMS, CAN was his first exposure to angel investment. While he had looked at several of the companies prior to joining CAN and eventually WIN as well, he wanted the reassurance of an investment group. One of the things that really struck me was just that as an individual walking into a potential investment is just so daunting, Preston says. Without an organization like this, I'm not sure I would have invested in anything. Ultimately, Sexton C. says that alumni are excited to see tangible products resulting from NC State's growing research arm. NC State's a very different university today than it was when many of our members were students on campus, and they really haven't really been back here except to attend a football or basketball game, Sexton says. To see young entrepreneurs who are coming out of the university and are tackling big problems using advanced technology, they want to be a part of that. Now we've reached the executive voice section of this day's Triangle Business Journal, and the executive voice is about Coon Rock Farm, and it involves the two people involved, Jamie Dement and Richard Holcomb. So this is the Q&A with Dement and Holcomb. For Richard Holcomb and Jamie Dement, striking out in a new direction is nothing new. Holcomb bought Coon Rock Farm in Hillsboro in 2004, and his partner Dement joined not long after. Holcomb is a serial entrepreneur with a keen interest in technology. He and Dement have a series of endeavors that include a farm, a restaurant, a cookbook, and Holcomb's tech businesses. Here, Dement and Holcomb give an update on what they are doing now and what's coming next. Now, this Q&A is held separately with the two people, so let me just start the Q&A with Jamie Dement. Tell us about the move to Hillsboro from Raleigh. My move to Hillsboro was an easy and welcome one. It was a move that was spurred by my relationship with Richard and our tie to Coon Rock Farm. So what advice would you have for others considering a change like that? Reach out to others who have made similar changes to make sure it's really what you want to do. We hear from friends all the time that they'd love to make a drastic change, leaving the rat race behind. That doesn't necessarily mean you need to quit your job and start a farm. You might just need a nice long vacation. Farming isn't for everyone. So what's the focus of your cookbook? Well, it's a seasonal book built around our life at Coon Rock Farm and the food coming out of our gardens each season. Hope that people enjoy the stories and take away an understanding from the recipes that cooking shouldn't be hard. If you're using fresh local ingredients, it's pretty easy to put a great healthy meal on the table. So is there a recipe in there you particularly love? Our kids love the grilled brown sugar pork spare ribs. My daddy loved the fried flounder and eggs, and Richard's favorites are the sage-rubbed pork chops. My favorite thing is to eat a steaming hot bowl of butter beans or field peas, so my single favorite dish is probably the field peas. You were ahead of the curve on the farm-to-table movement. Why did you see this with having such potential? Living in rural eastern North Carolina, I had a front row seat to watch a strong agricultural economy waste away. I always thought that something had to be done with all that unused farmland, and I have always known that people naturally want to feel connected to the earth. We may not always pay attention to the urge, but deep down we want to eat good food, and we want to know that it was produced in the best way possible. In the digital social media age we live in, it's easier and easier for people to actually see where the food comes from. So more people are paying attention and making demands for better food. And here's the Q&A with Richard Holcomb. Why did you buy the Hillsboro farm? I've always enjoyed getting in early on an interesting and fast-growing market. My first company, Q&E, built the first database application for Microsoft Windows. My second company, HAHT, did the same thing for the Internet. When I bought the farm 14 years ago, the local organic food scene was just starting to grow, and I have loved being a part of that from the beginning. So how has your tech and investing background helped you here? Good branding and marketing for food isn't that different than branding and marketing software. We use technology and social media to spread the word about our products and reach out into our community in the same way I did when I ran software companies. Well, are you still involved in the tech space? Yes. My third company, Strike Iron, was sold just a few years ago, and last year I co-founded a new healthcare software company, Solarian. It's focused on detecting and treating opioid abuse in a clinical setting. I'm in the process of moving that company from Houston to the Triangle now. So what are the next endeavors for you and Jamie? I'm excited about growing Solarian and continuing to explore the healthcare software world. We're currently touring with Jamie's The Farmhouse Chef and super excited for her next book, Canning in the Modern Kitchen, out next summer. So what are key lessons you've learned along the way? Hire great people. Don't be afraid to take a risk. Learn from your mistakes and modify plans accordingly. Is there a book you've read that particularly inspired you? Undaunted Courage, Stephen Ambrose's book about the Lewis and Clark expedition. That group launched off into truly uncharted territory without any idea of what was ahead of them, made amazing discoveries that changed the world, and came back alive. They traveled with an amazing woman who continually saved them along the way. I'm lucky to have this also. Now we move to the viewpoint page on an article on education. This is written by Charles Desmond, CEO of the nonprofit Inversant, and Robert Hildreth, a past member of the executive committee of the Boston University Board of Directors and board chairman of Inversant. The effect of America's student loan program on a country's young people is ground well covered. It's a $1.3 trillion mess with tentacles hurting spending power and reaching all sectors of the U.S. economy. The housing market, the stock market, automotive sales, holiday spending, and new business innovation are all stifled when recent graduates are forced to start paying down the interest on their higher education costs. Ironically, the biggest victim in this whole scenario may be the colleges and universities, who are charging outrageous tuition in the first place. For the sakes of both the schools and the students, this country has to fix this. Before the Higher Education Act of 1965, colleges, especially private ones, received little federal government assistance. They were bastions of white male privilege that countered the aims of President Lyndon Johnson and his great society for a more egalitarian society. With admirable intent, Johnson pried open the doors of academia to all genders, races, and ethnicities. It was paid for by having students take out loans rather than receiving grants, ignoring the successes of the GI Bill that had offered grants to millions of returning soldiers. The student loan program created perverse incentives. Colleges soon realized that any increase in tuition would be covered by students' ability to borrow from the government. Tuition shot up, never to come back to earth. Families bought into a culture of debt, accepting borrowing as the price for upward mobility. But colleges are now finding a downside, the educate students choking on debt. The slightest disruption at a college causes students to rethink their attendance. Once rare, transfers have climbed. Students increasingly vote with their feet. Some drop out due to cost. The student debt subsidy of $100 billion a year flowing into colleges has encouraged unhealthy risk-taking. It's facilitated a construction boom on many campuses as competition heats up for the best-looking buildings, offering the most up-to-date facilities from labs to climbing walls. Colleges must pay interest on construction bonds and set aside funds for long-term maintenance. At present rates of increase, tuition will top $100,000 annually within the next decade. For the top 200 colleges, their reputation will probably allow them to get that price. But for the rest of the 3,400 institutions, it poses a big risk. It's past time that officials intervene to save colleges from these self-inflicting behaviors. Colleges must prepare for enrollment declines over the next 5 to 10 years, based not just on demographic changes, but also on a slowdown in student loan growth. This could result from a tightening of federal policy or from a reluctance of families to keep borrowing. Ultimately, our courts and free market system may wipe away large swaths of student debt. It's only worth cents on the dollar in the marketplace, so it's better to liquidate it at its true price than have it burden our future. It's going to cost taxpayers to put our colleges on a surer footing. Student debt forgiveness will come at a heavy cost. Emergency aid to colleges may also be needed. In the end, it will require a grand compromise, balancing government aid against tuition reform. We have little choice. And in this week's editorial article written by the editor for Triangle Business Journal comes the article, College Angel Networks Serve a Bigger Purpose. To our regular online and print readers, this does not come as a surprise. The Triangle startup ecosystem needs more investors. We've heard this over and over again in the past decade. While many would argue that capital is available for innovation and research that solves an existing problem, there are many more who would say venture money is hard to come by. That's why these angel networks, started by local universities, are significant. They may not be able to help companies looking for later stage capital, but they offer promise to entrepreneurs just getting started. As our centerpiece on the operations of the Wolfpack Investor Network, Carolina Angel Network, Duke Angel Network, and NC Central's Eagle Angel Network shows, these networks are in their infancy. There's really no way to tell now if this model of investment will eventually work for the folks putting up the money, but it's a fantastic start. Here's a short history lesson. In the early 1950s, Governor Luther Hodges went along with a recommendation from a few Tar Heel businessmen and NC State University to commission Archie Davis to structure a research park. By 1958, Davis made a decision that would change North Carolina's economic picture forever. He argued and prevailed that Research Triangle Park should be a nonprofit entity when acquiring the land. The idea was to use the park more for public service, where companies and universities could come together to create amazing things. In the next 10 years, RTP welcomed Research Triangle Institute, Chemstrand Corporation, National Environmental Health Science Center, and the big one, IBM Corporation. The rest is history. If these managers of the angel networks play their cards right and treat their investors' money with care, the networks and the ones supporting them could be the springboard for the next set of rock star companies from the Triangle. In RTP's case, it really was relocation of established firms that grew the park. For WIN, DAN, CAN, and EAN, it will be the entrepreneurial community. An alumnus invested in one of the university angel networks said it perfectly. If you don't have a couple million dollars to lose, you shouldn't be involved in it. That's exactly the point. These investors need to approach their partnership with those angel networks as much more than just investing. Capital accessibility for Triangle entrepreneurs, along with the expertise and access to the Rolodex of the university alumni base, could be a game changer for the area, just like RTP. I'm all in with the angels on this one. Well, that music means we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleRadioReadingService.org. Sorry, that's TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.